or what do you blame for gun violence in the U.S.? Do you agree or disagree with the father of one of the victims in the Santa Barbara shootings on Friday who blames politicians and the National Rifle Association? That's today's big question. Richard Martinez, father of shooting victim Chris Martinez, wants others to join him to say enough is enough.
When will this insanity stop? When will enough people say, stop this madness? We don't have to live like this. Too many have died. We should say to ourselves, not one more.
I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, May 28th. We'll talk with a political scientist who's an expert on gun policy and gun politics, and we will welcome your questions and your answers. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Robert Spitzer is our guest. He is a distinguished service professor and chairman of the political science department at State University of New York College at Cortland. He has written 5 books on gun policy, including The Politics of Gun Control. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Richard Martinez, in no uncertain terms, pointed the finger at craven politicians and the NRA for getting in the way of tougher gun laws. Is it your sense that tougher gun laws would have prevented last week's attack in California?
Well, that's a good question. The first point to make is that gun violence generally has many causes, or violence generally has many causes, but when you introduce guns into the mix, it makes the likelihood of a deadly outcome greater. And with respect to the shooting in California, the young man who committed the act had obtained 3 handguns lawfully, and it did raise the question, as the anguished father was suggesting, about the fact that we do not have universal background checks for purchases of handguns throughout the country. So by a couple of estimates, between 30 and 40% of gun purchases in America occur without a background check. And, you know, that's a measure that nearly 90% of Americans support. It's a measure that most gun owners support. And when people, you know, do bad things with guns, it reflects badly on responsible gun owners. And that's part of the backstory behind this particular issue. One thing we can infer, at least, which is that he was not, while the shooter had 3 handguns in his possession, he did not have assault weapons with bullet magazines of greater than 10 bullets. He had a bunch of 10-bullet magazines with him in his car. And that indicates that he was not able to obtain magazines that have a higher capacity, which are legal in places other than California. So as much firepower as he had, apparently he could have gotten a lot more firepower had weapons with greater firepower because they were not available to him in California.
Yeah. Well, he obviously had some mental health issues. His family was very concerned about him for his very troubling videos that he was putting together. There was actually a police check at the shooter's home where he convinced them everything was okay. Had they searched the house, they would have found lots of rounds of ammunition and guns in one of the rooms. What about laws that are trying to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill?
Well, this is a very important and somewhat intractable issue. I think it's clear at the outset that more can and should be done to try and sever any link between the mentally ill and gun violence. Now, it's important to note that the overwhelming majority of people who have who are diagnosed as having mental illness problems are not violent. Only around 5% of the mentally ill nationwide have violent tendencies or are violent. And one of the things the mental health community is concerned with is painting the mentally ill with a broad brush, indicating that they are all or mostly violent, and that's certainly not the case. However, if there is mental illness present and it is diagnosable or has been diagnosed, there is surely a good reason to be to scrutinize to a greater degree whether those individuals should have easy access to guns. In addition, the mental health community has been, many of them have been very reluctant to make data available, partly out of privacy concerns and partly out of concerns that people who have mental illness would be stigmatized. Nevertheless, I think you can make a fair argument that we need more information available about mental illness conditions, especially if there's any possibility of an intersection between mental illness and gun possession, precisely because of the possibility, at least, of gun violence, whether it's against other people or whether it's people who have suicidal tendencies. And it's important to remember that there are twice as many gun suicides in America every year as there are gun homicides, and that's a very serious problem.
Yeah, and before the killings of the shooter, Roger posted a couple of videos on YouTube in which he said he would slaughter those who wronged him. Doesn't it seem like that should have been a gigantic red flag?
Well, it sure as heck does. It's not clear exactly who saw those posted YouTube videos, from what I've read at least, but they were clearly posted before the fact. His parents knew that something was seriously wrong, but they apparently, finally responded just too late. It certainly was a warning signal, and here again you see the confluence of three things in the case of this shooter. I mean, one was that he had these guns and ammunition readily available, which he did obtain legally. Secondly, he had clear mental health issues. He was under psychiatric care and had identifiable problems for several years. And the third thing was that his beliefs focused very specifically on, frankly, misogynistic beliefs. That is, this unlimited hatred against women. And perhaps that was, a pathological condition, but it does raise the question specifically of violence against women. And this is a very significant problem in America, and identifying it as a problem, I think, merits consideration too.
Yeah, there are laws on the books in Wisconsin, and I presume most other states too, that if you are convicted of course, it's after the fact. If you are convicted of domestic violence, you can't have a gun.
That is correct. There is a federal law, and I don't know about California state law, but it probably has something similar. So in terms of acts of domestic violence, that's right. But he had not actually committed an act of domestic violence. But given the confluence in these YouTube videos of his extreme statements of anger and how they were focused specifically against women, it does, again, raise this question for our society.
Paul in Elkhorn joins us. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Your guest started out by saying that universal background checks are well-regarded and all this wonderful stuff. The thing you must remember is California has a universal background check. He passed the universal background check. He waited the 10 days after passing the background check to pick up his firearms, and he still legally bought them. In addition, he stabbed three people before he shot anybody. So why are we talking about gun control? Why are we not talking about knife control? He also ran over four people with his car. Are we then going to talk about BMW control? I mean, this is ridiculous. Guns are purely a tool, and if you are intent on causing harm to people, you will find some way of doing it. There was mass stabbings in China, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a tool.
Robert Spitzer?
Well, the caller raises a number of points that have been raised about this and other instances, but there's several important points to make. It's absolutely true that his handgun purchases were legal. There's no doubt about that. However, that also raises a question of the nature of the background check. Now, in my home state of New York State, to obtain a pistol permit, the background check includes references, character references, who police investigate. I myself obtained a pistol permit last year, a concealed carry permit, and the police contact friends and neighbors and others, and they ask questions about this person's character. Had such a check occurred in California, and it did not, the authorities would have immediately discovered that this gentleman had serious, significant problems. So the nature of the check is part of the issue at play. Secondly, regarding the weapon involved, the weapons do matter. It is true, of course, that this man killed his three roommates with a knife, and you can kill people with all sorts of weapons. But a gun is more effective at killing people than other weapons. In fact, there's a term that's called the instrumentality effect. That is, the kind of instrument you choose has an effect on the outcome in terms of, you know, committing mayhem on other people. And he could not have driven around in his automobile in the Santa Barbara area and killed anybody by a drive-by knifing. That is, he was using his handguns to shoot people from his car. And yes, again, you can kill people with many different instruments, but cars are tightly regulated, and other behaviors are regulated as well. And ironically, guns are regulated probably less than most other consumer products.
We are talking with Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor and Chairman of the Political Science Department at State University of New York College at Cortland. He's written many books on gun policy, including The Politics of Gun Control. And we are talking about the politics of gun control. The father of one of the victims killed in Friday's mass shooting in California is blaming craven politicians and the NRA for his son's death, for doing nothing or blocking tougher gun legislation. So we are talking about that big question today and wondering if you agree or disagree with Richard Martinez. Do you blame politicians and the National Rifle Association? Yes, no, why or why not? What else? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In today's big question, we are asking who or what to blame for gun violence in the U.S. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking with Robert Spitzer, he is the author of The Politics of Gun Control, and we are welcoming your views, your questions, your answers. Matt on Facebook says, other countries are full of inanimate objects like guns and machetes too. How come they aren't killing people anywhere near the rate we tolerate here in the U.S.? Comments on that, Robert Spitzer?
Yeah, if you compare the United States to other similar nations, other Western democratic nations, what you find two things. One is that our overall crime rates are fairly comparable to those of other Western democratic nations. But there is one crime that is significantly different, and that's the murder rate. The murder rate in the United States is many times higher than it is in other Western democratic nations. And the chief reason for that is because of the proliferation of guns. And that's simply to make the point that firearms are a very efficient way to kill people. It's a more efficient way than any other interpersonal weapon that a person might use. And while the, you know, guns and gun culture is very much a part of our history in America, and there is a long and honorable tradition of gun ownership and responsible gun use, guns, and in particular handguns, are very much an implement of murder in the United States, and that largely explains why we have a much higher murder rate in comparison to other Western democratic nations.
Yeah. We certainly have our share of gun violence in Wisconsin, especially in our cities, big and small. In Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker's Democratic challenger Mary Burke said that she will work with Milwaukee leaders to find effective ways to keep crime down. There's been some very tragic shootings of children in parks and such. She and Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn also said that state Republicans are more concerned with tougher voting laws than they are with tougher gun laws. So are laws the only way to curb gun violence?
Well, no. And again, it's important to point out that enacting tougher laws is not like turning off a light switch, throwing a light switch or turning on or off a faucet, that if you have tougher laws, there will be no violence. But there is a correlation between those two things. And the law is one of the places that we turn to govern behavior in society. People, you know, often shrug their shoulders and say, well, the laws don't make any difference. But that's really not true. It depends on what the laws are, on how and where they are enforced, on how meaningful the measures are within them. And, you know, we regulate all kinds of behavior based on and using the law. And you certainly cannot say that because something bad happens, it doesn't mean that it means that laws simply don't mean anything. We turn to the law to establish what society standards and norms are and acceptable and unacceptable behavior. And it's also a basis for going after people who do bad things. And that is something that Americans agree on in every other realm.
Back to the phones. Kyle in Waukesha is with us. Hello, Kyle.
Hello. I first wanted to just say thank you for your guest recognizing the percentage of deaths on gun violence due to just suicide. I did a research, and what I wanted to say is I don't believe the government or the NRA is responsible for this. I think we have a lot of failings in our system, and I'm just curious if your guest knows the information on recidivistic crime and how much is gun violence with gang and or criminal activity versus normal people. And secondly, in the last study printed in 2012-2013, the number of wrongful deaths in hospitals was somewhere between 210,000 to 400,000. And I feel for the person who lost their family. I'm a fourth-generation military member. I've lost a lot of family. But the point being is that if we don't want to live that way, why is it okay to kill 20, 40 times as many people in our hospitals, let all of our mentally ill people out under the Reagan administration, and then wonder why they're doing this?
All right. Robert Spitzer?
Well, there are several issues the caller raises. People die from many causes, and people who are sick go to hospitals to seek treatment. I mean, if you have cancer, if you have a heart attack, I think you would be well advised to go to a hospital, even though there's a possibility that, for example, you might pick up an infection, which could wind up being more serious than the injury that brought you or the problem that brought you to the hospital. It's certainly a serious problem, but hospitals exist to help people get better, and by and large, they do. So I think that's kind of a different category of thing. In terms of recidivism, or that is the likelihood that crimes will be repeated, certainly we see with urban gangland-type violence and drug gangs and that kind of activity that there is a high rate of recidivism, and that's one of the intractable problems associated with urban violence. In terms of murder, the most serious crime, murder crimes generally have a low recidivism rate. People who commit murders are relatively unlikely overall nationwide to recommit those crimes.
Yeah. You know, I think the father of the shooting victim in California was blaming politicians and the NRA for either not doing anything to strengthen gun laws or blocking any gun laws since tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. I mean, we had Sandy Hook, Fort Hood, Columbine, Virginia Tech, Aurora. Why has anything seriously changed since those events?
Well, good question. At the national level, no. After the Sandy Hook shooting in December of 2012, President Obama pressed new gun measures in Congress in the spring of 2013, but they failed to muster the votes necessary in the U.S. Senate. And that effort obviously came to naught, and certainly a frustration for people who were supporting those measures. At the state level, however, we saw a great deal of action, and we have, America has a system of federalism, that is to say the national government exercises certain powers and the states have other powers, and oftentimes when the federal government fails to act on an important or pressing policy issue, the states do act, and we've seen that very much in the last year or so, where virtually every state of the union has enacted some kind of gun laws. About a dozen states enacted stronger gun laws, including California and New York and Maryland and others. And most of the rest of the states actually enacted laws that loosened gun regulations or made it easier to obtain guns in various ways. And that was kind of their statement to say that they believed that stricter gun laws were not the way to go.
Not like concealed carry, that kind of thing.
Making it easier. That states enacted laws to allow judges to carry guns in courts, allow for the possibility of gun carrying in buildings and locations not formally allowed, things like that. A lot of those looser laws had to do with carrying handguns. That's right. So we've seen a lot of action at the state level. Now, at the national level, we're in a political situation right now where there's so much hyper-partisanship and gridlock that it's very difficult to get much of anything done, much less an issue as contentious as gun policy. So that's the deep reason why we've not seen anything at the federal level.
We'll pick up on this after the news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live?
That was Richard Martinez, one of the father of one of the victims killed in Friday's shootings in California, blaming politicians and the NRA for his son's death. In today's big question, we are asking you, do you agree or disagree with Richard Martinez? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We do have our big question poll as well posted on Facebook and on our website at WPR.org/joy. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7:37 on this Wednesday, May 28th. We are talking with the author of The Politics of Gun Control about why it is so hard to pass stronger gun control laws. And we will ask if anything is likely to change now. And we wonder who or what you blame for gun violence. Our guest is Robert Spitzer. He is a distinguished service professor and chairman of the Political Science Department at State University of New York College at Cortland. Before we go back to the phones, Professor Spitzer, Richard Martinez, besides blaming craven politicians and the NRA for his son's death, also is urging like-minded individuals to follow his lead and send postcards and keep the pressure on politicians to tweet to say not one more, that this insanity has to stop. Is it likely that this high-profile case and his passion is likely to put the pressure on Congress, change anything now?
In the current political environment in Washington, D.C., it's extremely unlikely that we will see any significant action on the gun issue this year. It's an election year. Congress is very much in the thrall of gridlock, political gridlock, of a high degree of polarization, and it's been extremely difficult to get Congress to act on virtually any subject or any issue, much less an issue as contentious as gun politics. Although I would note that we have seen an upsurge in this past year or year and a half or so of greater mobilization on the sort of gun control side. Various organizations have sprung up, new organizations that are spending a fair amount of money on this issue, and it'll be interesting to see if it has any effect on the 2014 elections and perhaps even more importantly on 2016.
Is the NRA so powerful that it can stop any action on this issue?
Well, the NRA certainly has a great deal of influence It's a political organization that's been in the politics game for a long, long time. It was formed way back in 1871, although it didn't really become a hyper-political organization until the late 1970s. And it's been very effective in the past. I mean, it certainly doesn't always win, and I would add, I think the NRA's reputation, its bark is worse than its bite. But in more conservative and more conservative states and districts around the country, especially areas where Democrats are elected from more conservative areas, there is a reluctance to raise the ire of the NRA because it can complicate and make life, political life, difficult for office holders who might otherwise express support for stronger gun laws. And they certainly are very effective at what they do.
All right, many callers. So let's go to Doug in Waukesha next. Hello, Doug.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. Mr. Martinez is obviously attempting to make sense out of a senseless act, and while our heart goes out to him, I place the blame at Mr. Spitzer's and others like him in attempting to give Mr. Martinez an easy answer and an easy solution to preventing the senseless tragedy that took place. Mr. Spitzer talked about a number of things, one of which was he would like other states to enact the model that New York has, where the character of the person applying for the gun license is reviewed, and the state makes a decision upon the person's character whether or not they're going to allow him to him or her to exercise their constitutional right. It stands to reason that there should be other constitutional rights, and that the state would have the ability to determine whether or not you have the character to exercise or not. Here in Wisconsin, we're talking about voting laws. Maybe the state should review the constitutional right and character of the person who wants to vote, determine if you have the character to exercise that right.
All right. What's the difference between, you know, a character reference check for voting versus gun ownership?
Well, they're different rights. And I would add, I would say at the outset that the New York law that I made reference to earlier has withstood constitutional muster. There have been constitutional challenges, and the courts have upheld New York's law. Every constitutional right has particular traits, a particular constitutional law, a particular history. In the case of gun laws and gun regulations, I should point out that while gun ownership is as old as the United States, gun regulations are also as old as the United States, literally to the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. The American states and territories and localities had literally thousands of gun laws of every shape and variety. And indeed, in many respects, gun regulations in the 18th and 19th century were more strict than they are today. So I think it's hard to make any argument based on our own history to suggest that gun regulations are incompatible with gun rights. I think it's the opposite.
Are you giving Mr. Martinez an easy answer to a terrible tragedy?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I would certainly agree with Doug's point that there are no easy answers. I mean, that is certainly correct. I mean, if the laws were very different in California, would the killings in California have occurred? I mean, frankly, it's impossible to say based on a single case. The question is, though, what can we learn from that circumstance, and what does it tell us? How might it inform future decision-making? And that's a fair question, because we ask that question all the time when there's a coal mine cave-in or a nuclear power plant disaster, or, you know, when something terrible happens. One of the first questions we ask is, why did this happen, and can we do anything else to make it less likely that people will be hurt and killed in the future?
Yeah. And even if we do, though, pass tougher gun control laws, what's to stop people from getting a gun illegally? Many say that, you know, someone's set on killing people. Yeah. They're not going to care about a proper procedure. You know, and it's, you know, if you control guns, only criminals will have the guns.
Well, I think that misunderstands the purpose of law and what happens when you're trying to make the distinction between what is legal and what is illegal. The killer in California did obtain his three guns legally, but let's assume that, you know, California had a tougher background check system and had been denied the ability to obtain those three handguns legally. Well, perhaps he would have attempted to obtain guns illegally, perhaps not. If he had made such an attempt, where would he go? What would he spend? If you're attempting to obtain guns or doing anything illegally, you're automatically breaking the law, which would allow the police a chance to intervene. Also, such activity, if you're going to, let's say, the black market, is more expensive, it's more dangerous, it's less predictable. You're making it more difficult to do something that you don't want people to do in the first place. And that, again, is the very purpose of law.
To the phones again, Charles in Wausau is with us. Hello, Charles.
Hey, good morning. Let me just say that I do, in fact, teach a hunter safety course. I am a sportsman, and I support hunters' rights. But I do also believe, because I read National Rifleman, I believe the NRA plays a part here. So many of their articles feed into the myth that Obama is coming for your guns. They push the scarcity of resources argument that there aren't going to be enough guns or ammunition. Please buy, buy, buy. And I think the NRA as a sales organization feeds paranoia in this country. So they share some responsibility. When we talk about gun laws, we have to stop saying, well, this person could have obtained guns legally under the current laws anyway, because those laws are you know, artificially unrestrictive because of the NRA. So if we had different gun laws, maybe it would be harder for people to obtain these weapons.
All right. Thanks, Robert Spitzer.
Well, I think Charles makes a good point. I mean, when you look at, as I do as well, in addition to Charles, when you look at the literature, you know, the magazine articles, the mass mailers that the NRA sends out, it's extremely angry, defensive, apocalyptic rhetoric. It does indeed, it is a steady diet of really kind of paranoid, frankly, rhetoric about what the government is doing or what other groups are doing. I mean, you know, the NRA has a legitimate interest in terms of gun rights. That's, you know, that's certainly the case. But they do indeed feed their readers a steady diet of this extremely apocalyptic and paranoid writing about what the government is doing, where society is going, and I just don't think it serves any good purpose because it exaggerates what is otherwise a legitimate activity.
Judy in Burlington is with us now. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Good morning. Okay, first of all, my feeling is it's not the weapon that's the problem. It's the person. If this person wouldn't have been able to get a gun, maybe he would have gotten a knife. And like the young boy who went into the school and slashed and killed how many people, he could have used something like that.
Yeah, but
regulation. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. We did address this in the first half hour, but what was what else? What did you want to add?
Okay. Well, I'm just thinking. You know, if they say, okay, well, now this guy got this knife, and he went out and he killed people. So now what are we going to do? Going to go to a good restaurant to get a steak and have our steak come out all cut up for us because they don't want us to handle steak knives?
No, that's not going to happen, is it, Robert Spitzer?
Well, no. And this returns us to a very important issue, which is, does it make any difference what instrument you use to commit mayhem? And the answer is yes, it makes a big difference. There was a teenager who went to a school in Pittsburgh not too long ago and knifed roughly 20 classmates who use a knife and not a gun, but all of those people survived. On the day that the Sandy Hook shooting took place in December of 2012, when the shooter killed over 20 people, there was also a knifing in an elementary school in China, in the People's Republic of China, where somebody went after children and hurt over 20 of them, but none of them died. This fellow in California killed his three roommates with a knife, and I think that the story is that the allegation is that they were asleep at the time, and he hacked them and killed them with a knife, and you can absolutely do that. But if he had had a knife with him instead of a gun when he was driving around Santa Barbara, he would not have been able to hurt and kill from a distance anybody with a knife. The instrument that you, the person matters, but so does the implement that you use.
Yeah. Well, I thought Judy was also going to talk about that we need to treat mental illness, and that would have a big impact on these types of mass shootings. I mean, I know that that Richard Martinez said he did not fault the mental health system. He did say that it was very hard for parents to get help for their mentally ill children. Do we have to do something when it comes to treating the mentally ill, changing laws along those lines?
I think we do, and states are starting to struggle with this very issue. Part of the problem comes in the collision between identifying people with mental problems who might be prone to violence and the desire to keep that information private in the name of, you know, physician patient confidentiality. And many in the mental health community have been extremely reluctant to make any such data available to law enforcement, especially in cases of violence. That's a problem. Better data collection is a problem. There is a background check system in place for purchase of handguns, and under federal law, if you're, you know, judged mentally incompetent, you're not supposed to be able to obtain a gun. But even today, many states don't report very much of that data to the national system, and if you're not in the data bank, then they, you know, a gun sale cannot be blocked. So reporting is an issue, and also identification of which types of mental illness are connected with violence and which are not would be helpful as well.
Yeah. As we conclude our big question, should we expect anything to happen in the way of gun control or better mental health treatment following this latest shooting in California?
Well, the one area where there could be some movement in the near term is on the mental health issue, precisely in terms of getting better information of mental health officials working more closely with law enforcement, of having better data collection. There's general agreement that people who have, and indeed most mass shooters that we know about, at least in modern times, have had clearly identifiable mental health problems and have also given off warning signals that that they were going to commit mass violence, as did this gentleman out in California. So that does suggest that there is a movement, that there is more that can be done to sever the link between guns and those with serious mental health issues who are violence prone. And that's one area where I think we could see some advance, not only at the among many states, but even at the federal level.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor and Chairman of the Political Science Department at State University of New York College at Cortland. He's written 5 books on gun policy, including The Politics of Gun Control. Well, you've heard from him. You've heard from some of our callers. What do you think? Who or what do you blame for gun violence in the U.S.? The father of one of the victims killed in Friday's shootings in California blames politicians and the National Rifle Association for blocking tougher gun legislation. Do you agree with him or not? 1-800-642-1234. Time for you to sound off, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll give you 30 seconds to state your case. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. In today's big question, we are asking you, who or what do you blame for gun violence in the U.S.? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. This is our sound off segment where we give you 30 seconds to state your case. And our first caller is Mike in Oshkosh. Hello, Mike.
Hello, how are you this morning? Interesting topic. I'd like to say this. I don't think that the gun issue is an issue that could be looked at as strictly a gun issue. I think it's a societal issue. And I think if we want to cure the problem of gun violence, we must first look at our own parenting skills and really take a hard look at those, and that we have become so permissive that our prisons are full of people who have let their emotions dictate their realities.
Thank you very much, Mike. That's your 30 seconds. Dave on Facebook says, once again, look at Americans' youth's role models. Extremely violent movies and video games, violent sports, and most importantly, the President of the United States who executes without trial. We teach our children to solve problems with violence. That's what Dave thinks. What do you think? Let's go to John in Somerset. Hello, John.
Yes, I was wondering why they always target these gun-free zones, these shooters and stuff like that, you know?
So what's your theory?
Well, I think they're looking for vulnerable people that in society that can't defend themselves. And the only time that, the violence stops is when the guns show up. So when they're confronted with that, they take their own lives.
Thank you very much, John. Who or what do you blame for gun violence? Anne in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I think as long as we allow the NRA to write our gun laws in exchange for large amounts of money to politicians, we're going to have this problem. And we've got a lot of paranoid, angry, insecure, misogynist men in this country who are fully armed. And I honestly believe we need to repeal the Second Amendment.
All right. Thank you very much, Anne. We go to Dave now, Lake in the Hills. Hello, Dave.
Yes.
Yes, what do you think?
Well, I think these people are mentally disturbed. They're not stupid. That's why they choose to go to places where the government said that people aren't allowed to protect themselves. I have never heard of anybody going into a police department to do a shooting because that just wouldn't go over very well. They go to places like restaurants where people are forced to leave their guns in their car, or they go to school where no one's allowed to have a gun.
All right. Thank you very much. A couple of people thinking we got to do away with gun-free zones. Let's go to Camille in New Berlin. Hello, Camille.
Thank you. I blame the Republican Party, ALEC, and the NRA for continuing the paranoia that we need all the guns in the world, and if people don't like it, quit voting for Republicans.
All right, thank you very much. Andy on Facebook says, sick and paranoid sums up the gun culture. The rest of us have rights, including the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is less likely when we are surrounded by careless people packing heat. And another listener on Twitter says, our culture industry promotes violent culture where youth learn to resolve issues by violence. All right, well, I think that's going to be it for our sound off portion of today's big question. You can continue voting online. We do have a question posted online. You can find it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or at WPR.org/joy. Today's big question asks, Richard Martinez, the father of one of the victims of last week's mass shooting in Santa Barbara, California, blamed the violence on politicians and the National Rifle Association for blocking tougher gun laws. And we ask if you agree with Martinez or disagree with Martinez, or if you're not sure. You can continue voting online. Thanks to Bill Martins, to Robin Cherry, to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.